Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Brett Schultes, WITF's Transforming Health reporter, and I'm filling in today for Scott Lamar. Bucknell University researchers have spent the past 3 years testing two common vaping products, also known as electronic cigarettes. Their research has found that electronic cigarettes release potentially harmful levels of carbon monoxide, the same common toxic gas that is found in a car's tailpipe emissions and which is also found in cigarette smoke. This finding challenges vaping industry claims that electronic cigarettes are less dangerous than smoking. Joining me today is Debrina Dutcher, Assistant Professor of Chemistry and Chemical Engineering at Bucknell. Welcome, Debrina.
Thank you.
Also with us is Karen Castle, Associate Dean of Faculty in the Natural Sciences and Mathematics Department. Welcome to Smart Talk.
Thank you.
So let's get started by talking about how this all came about. You didn't set out initially to research vaping, is that right?
I'm an atmospheric chemist by training.
And what does that mean, atmospheric chemist?
So I do a lot of aerosol research. I look at the solid particles and liquid particles in the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And how about you, Karen?
Well, I'm a laser spectroscopist, and I do most of my work on planetary climate models and doing lab experiments that support modeling atmospheres.
Yeah, and laser spectroscopy. Laser work. I found myself in the basement there at Bucknell, seeing where the research was conducted, and I saw just how big that operation is. How does all that tie into vaping?
Well, it's interesting. I have this great system in that lab in the basement of Root Chemistry, and we have the ability to detect really tiny concentrations of gases, certain gases that are atmospherically important. I was actually looking for new applications, new things to look at. And then Debrina and I got together one day over lunch and were talking about the possibilities. She had this system that she believed was producing carbon monoxide. I have a way to detect very small amounts of it. So we eventually came up with this project.
And my understanding is that students, undergraduate students, played a role not only in the research, which I know from doing the story, you know, I worked with, talked to two of the students who are researchers, but additionally, students kind of sparked an interest in this. Is that right?
So I have a lot of instrumentation that looks at particles and characterizes particles. And I had students come to me with e-cigs when they were first starting to get popular and say, couldn't we use some of your equipment to characterize what's coming out of these? And after I thought about it, I realized you could, which sort of sparked a whole new research direction in my lab.
Mm-hmm. And that I also find to be interesting and, I don't know, maybe a little bit troubling, because so much of the narrative around electronic cigarettes and vaping has been, for at least part of the past 10 years, that it's a great way and a safer way for people who smoke or have smoked to quit smoking and to kind of move into a safer transmission of getting that nicotine that they want. It strikes me that college students and even high school students who, you know, might be 18, 19, 20 years old, are growing up maybe having never smoked.
That's right. I've seen a lot of my students admit that they've never smoked, but they've vaped.
Mm. And we'll just real briefly, I have to ask, do you tend to see, or is this something that you could quantify in any way, you know, more of that going on the Bucknell campus than you would have, you know, 5 years ago? Or is that hard to say?
It's hard to say, but it's my sense that that's true. Yeah. That's what my students tell me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So let's talk about the main finding of this research and then get into a little bit of how you got to that finding.
Mm-hmm. So what we found is that e-cigarettes definitely do produce carbon monoxide. The relationship between the power of the e-cigarette and the carbon monoxide is exponential. So the more power you provide to your e-cigarette, the more carbon monoxide you make. And we found out that the flavor of the e-juice that you use affects the amount of carbon monoxide that you make.
All right. You mentioned e-juice. So let's pause for a second and talk about what goes into vaping. And then maybe we can break that down a little bit more. So I know for people who may use electronic cigarettes, they already know this. But for everybody else, can you break down a little bit of the mechanism of what happens inside of one of those devices?
Well, they're actually pretty simple devices. It's e-juice, this liquid that's mostly propylene glycol and vegetable glycerin and then flavoring agents, is transported to a wick That wick goes up into a filament that's resistively heated, and that aerosolizes the juice itself, which is usually where the nicotine is. But what this research shows is since we're making carbon monoxide that wasn't there to start with, there's also chemical reactions happening.
Yeah.
So it's not just aerosolizing the juice.
And that's really significant, right?
That's huge because we don't know what else that's making.
Why is that significant to people in the vaping industry who might have been saying that this is a very safe means of transmission?
Yeah, so one of the things this points out is that more research is needed in this area. So the claims that e-cigarettes may be safe because they're not combusting, there's not a combustion reaction happening, sounds very reasonable. But this work shows that there are chemical reactions happening, and so you are still producing products that could be potentially harmful. And we need a lot more research in this area to know what those health effects are going to be.
So you say when you say chemical reactions are happening, of course, that sounds to the layperson like it could mean any number of things. But combustion is a chemical reaction.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what's happening here?
Well, I think it's a form of oxidation. So combustion is a form of oxidation. And I think what we're observing here is a form of oxidation because we're making carbon monoxide, which is usually a product of incomplete combustion or partial oxidation.
Yeah, yeah. So, you're finding this carbon monoxide. Can you speak to the magnitude of it or how much a person would actually be getting if they were using these devices?
Well, I can say that in our initial study, we went in expecting to find small amounts, small concentrations of carbon monoxide, and we were very, very surprised by the high levels that we were measuring at the very first try.
Describe that a little bit more. What kind of levels are we talking about, and what did you think whenever you started seeing them?
Well, our first run, our signal was saturated, which means we were producing so much carbon monoxide that it was absorbing the laser entirely. So very, very high concentrations, much higher than I was anticipating seeing.
Hmm. How would those concentration levels compare to what you'd find in, say, a cigarette?
It depends on how you've set up your e-cigarette, because, again, it depends on flavoring and it depends on the power that you're using your e-cigarette at. So if you're using it in a very gentle way, it might be lower. And if for some reason you have your e-cig turned way up, it could actually be more than you see in a typical regular cigarette.
Right, and that this has been a learning process for me as well. As I reported the story, electronic cigarettes have a power adjuster on them that would control how many watts of electricity kind of heat up the filament.
That's right.
And so I know one thing I've heard people, and we can get more into this, sort of how I think it's important to look at this from the vaping industry's perspective as well as those who are people who have turned to vaping as a safer or a less dangerous alternative to smoking. But so the power settings are adjustable on these. I've heard people say that, well, listen, you know, we're not going to, most people don't use these devices at those high power level settings. So kind of how would you respond to that?
I'd like to say, I think one of the things that I really enjoyed about the study is that we actually point to directions that could be taken to make vaping safer right now. So I'd love to see manufacturers limit the upper end of that power band. You know, right now, a lot of the more expensive devices go up to about 200 watts. There's no reason to go that high if most people aren't using them that high. So why don't we limit to 100 so that no one can accidentally do that?
And can you speak at all to the difference in the carbon monoxide saturation between the lower level and the higher level?
It's huge. It's an exponential relationship. So it goes dramatically up with power.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's really interesting to look at it from that vantage point. So can you talk a little bit more about other significant elements to this finding? Because I know that carbon monoxide itself is one thing, but I know from talking with you before, it also points to some other possibilities that could be in there.
Yeah, so we're in the process of studying more about the role of the flavoring agents, the role of things like menthol, So it could be possible that there are certain choices you could make to make the vaping safer beyond just the power settings.
Mm. Can you talk a little bit more about that? I'm not sure that I 100% know what you mean.
Yeah, so we are seeing that these chemical reactions are happening. We don't yet know exactly what those reactions are. We would love to know if there are particular ingredients in the e-liquid that lead to higher carbon monoxide levels. It's certainly possible that there are certain combinations of things that are going to be safer.
Well, let's talk about that because people who support the use of vape, support vaping, have said to me that these are very simple. These flavorings and these e-juice packets, they contain nicotine, they contain propylene glycol, vegetable glycerin.
That's right.
And then, as they would say, food grade, which I guess means USDA approved or food grade flavorings. So, can we get more specific on those flavorings?
They're proprietary, so no.
Mm.
They don't have to tell you what's in them. And the other thing I would point out along those lines is because something's safe to eat doesn't mean it's safe to absorb through your lungs. That's a very different mechanism. So
sure.
That's a huge assumption that you can go from one to the other.
Do you think we need to be doing more to regulate that or at least know what's in that?
I think more research is definitely called for on these.
Uh-huh. And it also makes me wonder if the, you know, if the different flavorings have different ingredients in them based on which one they are. Because, I mean, we see these if you go to even not even just some of the electronic cigarette stores, but even, you know, convenience stores will have some of this stuff. And it's like, you know, cotton candy flavor and mint and just, I don't know, just all kinds of flavors. So I would assume that some of them would have different ingredients than others and that those might respond in different ways.
Exactly. And I think we need a lot more work in that area to know what the effects of those are going to be. As Debrina said earlier, these things are safe in terms of digestion, right? Mm-hmm. But yeah, we just need a lot more work done to understand what effects they would have when you inhale them.
Right. You make an excellent point. It may be extremely safe to eat lettuce, but it doesn't mean I want to smoke it.
Right.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR news and all things regional. I'm Brett Schultes, WITF's Transforming Health reporter, and I'm filling in for Scott Lamar today. And joining me today is Debrina Dutcher, Assistant Professor of Chemistry and Chemical Engineering at Bucknell, as well as Karen Castle, Associate Dean of Faculty in the Natural Sciences and Mathematics Department. We're here talking about a study that Debrina and Karen, as well as some students, including undergraduate students, worked on. It was a 3-year study, and it found that common electronic cigarettes and vaping devices are releasing carbon monoxide. You know, one thing maybe we didn't clarify enough when we were talking was this is a study that was not clinical trials. It was not involving humans. It was involving a laser and a pump.
That's correct.
It makes me wonder if going forward there we would need to do more, and this may be outside of your ability to do this, but studies that would involve people to see how they're actually using these devices.
I'd love to see someone do a study measuring carboxyhemoglobin after people vape.
Right. So break that down, carboxyhemoglobin. Talk a little bit about what that is.
So, of course, your hemoglobin is supposed to carry oxygen in your blood. But when you have a lot of carbon monoxide exposure, your hemoglobin will actually form carboxyhemoglobin. And then it can't carry oxygen as effectively because it's tied up with the carbon monoxide. And I'm willing to bet that if someone were to measure vapors after they vaped, that they're going to have measurable concentrations of carboxyhemoglobin in their bloodstream.
How would that compare to what you'd see in a pack-a-day smoker?
Probably very similar. I wouldn't expect there to be a big difference.
Yeah,
right.
I wouldn't either.
And so that really goes against the notion that I think has been very effectively handed to people, including younger people, that with vaping they can get a lot of the benefits of whatever the pleasure of smoking or of taking in nicotine without pretty much any health effects or side effects.
That's certainly what they've been told.
Yeah, and it seems that may not be the case at all. And this is coming. This study is 3 years in the making. It's something you were working on long before we heard about this vaping related illness that now has claimed, I think, at least 34 lives in 49 states at this point, according to Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. More than 1,600 people have been hospitalized for it. Pennsylvania's Department of Health has been very active in tracking down cases and monitoring cases in Pennsylvania. We've had at least one death in Pennsylvania as a result of this. And now the centers, now the CDC is saying that if you, first of all, if you have vaped or are vaping THC-related products, those are, you know, products that would involve cannabis or the what's in marijuana that gets you high, they're saying just don't do it, especially if they were purchased on the, you know, illicitly. But even more so, they're saying if you don't vape, don't start. And if you do vape, try to quit. So that really says to me that, you know, they are looking into what else might be at work here. So what do you know about that?
It's pretty far outside my field.
Yeah.
I follow the news on it and do the reading just like everyone else. And it seems like they are tying it more to the THC products, which is nice because for a long time it was unknown. So at least now we have a direction that we're looking at it.
Well, and those THC products, much like the nicotine-based products, have an e-juice in them, right? So there would still be something at work where something is getting burned. Is that right?
I expect so. We've never tested those, though.
Well, let's talk about kind of where you would hope to go with this research next.
Yes. So one of the things we're working on right now is looking at the different flavorings and focusing on that a little bit more, just to see if we see we're going to stick with the carbon monoxide angle a little bit more because it's interesting. We want to see if we can relate the type of flavoring used to the amount of carbon monoxide produced.
You say the type of flavoring, so you're thinking that certain e-juice packages are going to have a measurably different effect on people.
That I can confirm.
That was part of the study.
That was part of that study, but that's also work we've done since then. And it's absolutely true that different flavors have produced drastically different amounts of carbon monoxide.
Right. And at the least, that might be an indication that further breaking down of this proprietary, you know, e-juice packets and flavorings might be worthy of, you know, at least further examination. I have to say, I spoke to people who, you know, are in the vaping industry, as well as people who actually vape. And, you know, I hear a common narrative, which is that vaping has saved my life. Vaping has helped me to quit smoking. And when I hear from somebody who used to smoke a pack of cigarettes a day or even more than that and who's been cigarette free for a while, I mean, I have to have a lot of sympathy for that person. And so, you know, vaping is being seen as this safer alternative. So for those people, they're going to hear this study, and I wonder if that, you know, learning that carbon monoxide is being released from these devices, if that's really something that's going to concern them when their alternative is to be smoking a cigarette, perhaps.
I suspect you're right, and I get asked the question a lot, you know, do I want e-cigarettes banned? And I don't. For people who were smoking regular cigarettes, this probably is a safer alternative. My bigger concern is with especially younger kids who are starting to vape. They were never addicted to cigarettes. It's not an alternative. They're not using them to get unaddicted to regular cigarettes. There's a whole generation that's starting with these devices. And yes, they're probably safer than regular cigarettes, but that doesn't make them safe.
Yeah, that's a fair point, especially when you're considering people that may have never smoked a cigarette in their life. And just to be clear, because I was looking at some of the findings here, and when the e-cigarettes were turned up to their maximum setting, that would be 200 watts.
For the one we had, yes.
Those levels were 20 times higher than outdoor air quality standards. What does that mean?
Well, it's a lot of carbon monoxide. If you are exposed to that amount of carbon monoxide on a continuous basis, not just for a short burst, but for hours on end, it could actually be fatal.
How would it compare to cigarette smoke?
Well, the upper end actually is greater than cigarette smoke. Now, if you're using your e-cigarette in a more typical way with a power turn to a more moderate level, it is actually less carbon monoxide than you would see from a regular cigarette.
And so far, we've sort of talked about carbon monoxide in terms of how it's a marker for other things that may be being released that we don't know about yet, that you haven't tested for. So things that are in those e-juices that we may not know about yet. Carbon monoxide itself, of course, is also toxic. Is also something that is bad for you. And we talk about how it could kill you in high doses or prolonged doses. I think it might be also worth touching on even just that lower dose continued exposure over months and years. That also has an effect on a person. Is that right?
It could potentially. I don't think we really know very much about what that kind of exposure to carbon monoxide might do.
And the literature is very weak on this. I've done several literature searches looking for information about shorter term exposures. And there's maybe one or two papers out there. But what it does point to when you read those papers is that for vulnerable populations, so we're talking pregnant women, people with lung diseases, even short term carbon monoxide exposure can be serious.
Yeah, absolutely. Talking about different papers and different studies, I spoke with somebody who pointed me also to another study that came out, I think it was in January, it was earlier this year, and it was focused on one particular type of device called, and this is just such an interesting little rabbit hole to go down, but a device is called sub-ohm electronic cigarettes. And what I learned was that people were modifying their devices, and it gets a little bit technical, but they were lowering some of the resistance on the filaments so that apparently they could create even higher levels than what the devices were designed for. And that as a result of that, they'd be able to do things like maybe really blow like a lot of, like do tricks with the aerosolized, I guess it's not smoke technically, but with the vapor. That says something to me as well about the way that people are actually interacting with these devices. If a person is willing to modify their device, then I don't know that I buy the idea that, everybody out there using these is setting them at 50 watts or 100 watts and not ever going up into the upper registers of them. And I guess that's something that, again, we have pretty limited data on.
This whole cloud chasing phenomenon, these people who do these tricks and they actually have competitions looking at these different tricks. It's a fascinating subculture as far as I'm concerned. Watching some of these videos have been absolutely hysterical.
Right. Hysterical, but at the same time, maybe worthy of concern, right?
I really secretly want to run into one of these competitions where they're doing this and measure the carbon monoxide in the room. I really do.
Well, let's on that note, jump over and talk a little bit more about how this has been a real area of study for some of your students. Talk about how that got started. And, where that's leading the undergraduate students. I think it's fascinating that undergraduates kind of were crucial and key in making this happen.
Yes, we've had 4 undergraduate students working on this project so far, and they've been fabulous. They've been involved with every aspect of the project, from the design work, actually taking the data, the analysis. And they've been fantastic.
Yeah, it's a little shameful that we're taking credit for what really is a lot of their work, because we mostly stood there and watched as they did the work.
That's right.
And are they continuing to do work on this front?
We have 2 of the students who are on the paper who are still doing work with us. They're doing the work with the flavoring agents. And then we've got 1 student who had the nerve to graduate and leave us.
Right.
And she's in grad school up at Cornell now. And another student is down at Carnegie Mellon, finishing up her degree down there.
So seeing this study, which is about to be published in the British Medical Journal, Tobacco Control, this study is now released, is about to be released there. Are you starting to get any feedback from colleagues in terms of either any limits to the study or any directions it's pointing you towards from here?
I think there are many different directions it could go, and that's why it's been such an interesting project. We have some short-term plans, but this could evolve into a longer-term project as well. There are just so many things that we still don't know and would like to better understand so that we can convey that to people who may be e-cigarette users.
Well, let's touch on that one more time. You say there are still so many things we don't know. What are some of the key things we still don't know here?
We don't know exactly what the chemical reactions are that are happening, and we don't necessarily know all of the factors that are going to influence those reactions and affect the production of carbon monoxide and other things that may be harmful.
Yeah, and yet these devices are now ubiquitous. They are not just sold in, vape-specific shops. They're sold at convenience stores. The e-liquids themselves are commonplace and found throughout. So they're very much part of our sort of consumer culture here. And if you had the power to make some changes in terms of the way that people have access to them, what do you think might be a few wise things that need to be done here?
Well, I would love it if fewer children were using these, first of all. I would love to see limits on the power of the devices.
And if it were up to me, I don't think we should have proprietary flavoring agents when we're expected to consume them.
Yeah, that is sort of a standard that we don't necessarily even see on our food now,
right,
in many regards. Well, it's been a real pleasure talking to both of you. I really appreciate your time today, and this has been fascinating.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Smart Talk, and I'm Brett Schultes. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Brett Schultes, WITF's Transforming Health reporter, and I'm filling in for Scott Lamar today. Applied behavior analysis is a type of therapy that focuses on improving specific behaviors. Those can range from social skills and reading to working on things like fine motor dexterity, hygiene, and grooming. It's especially effective in helping children with autism to adapt to the pressures of school, social settings, and to help them with things at home. And it's also a type of therapy that can help people living with addiction or behavioral disorders. But for those in need of a qualified therapist, the problem is, in Pennsylvania, there aren't enough of them. I'm joined here today with Dr. Cheryl Tierney Avis, a doctor who specializes in behavior and developmental pediatrics, who is leading an effort to set up a licensure process for applied behavior analysts, which she says will solve or help to solve this problem. Welcome to the show, Dr. Tierney.
Thank you so much for having me.
Also with me today is Dr. Jonathan Ivey. He's an assistant professor of psychology at Penn State Harrisburg, who has a doctorate in applied behavior analysis and special education. He's worked with individuals who engage in severe challenging behaviors at the group and individual level for more than a decade. And welcome to the show, Dr. Ivey.
Brett, it is a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
So let's start with you, Dr. Ivey, because we need to bring people up to speed on what can often be a little bit of a complicated topic if you're not already familiar with it. So what is applied behavior analysis?
Now, that's a great question. So applied behavior analysis is a science in which interventions derived from basic principles of learning are applied systematically to improve socially meaningful behavior.
That was a very textbook definition.
Oh, absolutely. So to say it simply, behavior analysis is the study of why we do what we do.
Yeah.
Applied behavior analysis, then, is the application of that information to bring about meaningful change, improve lives, really just help us live a happy, healthier lifestyle.
Let's take the example of somebody who has autism. And specifically in my reporting, I've worked with the parents of children who are on the autism spectrum and how applied behavior analysis has helped them. So kind of give me a little more detail on how applied behavior analysis would be used to help a child who might be struggling with something at school or at home.
Sure. I think the best way to understand applied behavior analysis is really the process, the underlying process as to how we would go about helping that individual. The first thing we would do is meet with family, other professionals, and really identify what are the specific skills and targets that, were we to develop interventions, would bring about meaningful change. What makes behavior analysis unique is the functional perspective that we take when applying these kinds of situations. So, for example, if we're working with an individual who has some kind of aggressive or self-injurious behavior, we seek to first understand why that behavior occurs. What is the cause of that behavior? As strange as it may seem, that problem behavior, a child hitting himself or herself in the head, that behavior has a functional purpose for that individual.
Wow.
So once we can identify why these things happen, we're in the best position to go about developing intervention and then ultimately teaching a better way to interact with the world.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. How would that then differ from other therapies that are out there, though, or how would it be similar to or different than other therapies?
Well, for sure, a behavior analyst often interfaces with a multidisciplinary team. So we certainly interact with other professionals. But to your question, a behavior analyst would look at the individual in the context, the environment, the setting in which they live. So we would attempt to identify what are the things that happen prior to behavior that make it more likely. Mm. Also, what are the things that happen after behavior that may strengthen or increase that behavior in the future, really give it purpose and meaning?
I see. So I'm going to jump over to you, Dr. Tierney, and you said on second reference, just call you Dr. Tierney.
Absolutely.
And let's talk about how you got involved in this. Coming from another state and trying to do this work here in Pennsylvania.
Yeah. So I got involved. It was actually several years ago. I moved here in 2010, and I worked up in the New England states, When I moved here, I realized that children that were receiving this ABA therapy in New England were receiving services by behavior analysts, which is the service provider that should be developing these behavior plans and implementing them. When I got here in 2010, one of the first questions I asked my colleagues and my partners was, you know, where are the behavior analysts? Because that is the profession that should be providing ABA therapy, much like if you're prescribing speech therapy, that would be done by a speech pathologist, or occupational therapy, that would be delivered by an occupational therapist. And for the most part, when families are requesting those interventions, they don't have to worry about who would be delivering that therapy to their children. When I got here and I asked who was providing ABA therapy, pretty much unanimously, I was told that you don't get that here, which is pretty surprising because for the last 20 years, children were receiving that in New England. And I was surprised that families were unaware of this intervention and were not receiving it. So shortly after arriving, about 10 years ago, I started a nonprofit that was advocating to improve the quality and access to ABA therapy because it is the most effective intervention for improving developmental skills and reducing problematic behaviors for the population of kids that I was seeing.
Yeah. And I want to get into some more of those details momentarily. I have to ask, can you help to characterize what's at stake here, though?
Yeah.
And, you know, why? So Pennsylvania doesn't have applied behavior analysis as a licensed, recognized medical profession. Why does that matter? Because the only way in which, you know, how does it affect and get down to that child who has autism or that person who's struggling with some other behavior? What's at stake here?
Right. So we do have behavior analysts in our state. So I don't want to mislead the public into thinking that we don't have behavior analysts. We certainly don't have enough, but we do have some. But the problem is that because we don't have a professional license for this profession, it is confusing to the public. When I, as a prescriber, as a professional, order ABA intervention for these kids, I write a prescription, much like I write a prescription for speech therapy, occupational therapy, or physical therapy. I write a prescription for ABA therapy, same way. Mm-hmm. But when a family goes to get that filled, it may not be a behavior analyst that fills that prescription. It could be a different discipline.
I mean, that just seems like that would be like if you were prescribing someone to go to a physical therapist, and when you got there, you got someone who wasn't actually licensed to do physical therapy. Who are these people who are doing this work?
Right. So they are professionals, but they're not professionals that are behavior analysts. So they might be social workers. They might be licensed professional counselors.
Yeah.
They are different disciplines.
And I have tons of respect for social workers.
Absolutely.
And all those
Absolutely.
People.
But I mean, I work with social workers. I work with the other professions that are filling those roles. But they're not behavior analysts.
Right. And so a behavior analyst has a master's degree or doctoral degree in specifically in applied behavior analysis.
That's correct.
And 30 other states, I think roughly 30 states have licensure for this, but Pennsylvania doesn't. Am I right?
That's correct.
That's correct.
Okay.
Yes.
So I have to ask then, you said there are, because my understanding is part of the problem here is that they aren't getting the applied behavior analysts who are working in Pennsylvania, there's no mechanism for them to really get paid. They are getting paid in some cases, right, when dealing with children. Is that what it is?
Right. So for children under the age of 21, we do have an autism insurance law, and that's Act 62 that passed in 2008. And because that law passed, there had to be a funding mechanism by which professionals who were not licensed could contract with insurance companies to get paid. And that license is called a licensed behavioral specialist. There is no profession behavioral specialist. That doesn't exist. Mm. So many different professions can apply and get that license. So it does become confusing because people think that this license means that you are a behavior analyst, but that's not true. Mm-hmm. That license is an administrative license, so to speak, where you fill out paperwork and you have certain qualifications and a little bit of experience in some of these techniques, but you don't have anywhere near the education, experience, or training to be able to develop and implement behavior plans the way a behavior analyst would. And for these complicated cases, it really isn't adequate for these kids to make the developmental gains and reduce the problematic behaviors that are necessary. And so I'm sure many families listening to this can relate to the fact that we tend to treat these same problems over and over for years and years, and many of these children don't get better and don't develop the skills that they should. And where they might be getting better in other states.
Yeah.
Who might be.
And in my experience reporting on it, that was what was always very much at the center of this is parents who are so desperate to get help for their kids who may be falling behind in school or just barely hanging on by a thread at school. I do have to take a quick break. We're going to take a break and then we're going to come right back. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Brett Schultes, WITF's Transforming Health Reporter, and I'm filling in for Scott Lamar today. I'm joined here with Dr. Cheryl Tierney-Avis, a doctor who is leading an effort to set up a licensure process for applied behavior analysis. Also with me today is Dr. Jonathan Ivey, who is an applied behavior analyst and also a professor. Welcome back, and let's pick up where we left off. We were talking about those parents. They have really played a big role, I think, in pushing and helping you get that licensure process. So talk about the role that they've played and why this matters to them.
Right. So when I first started on faculty at Penn State Hershey Children's Hospital, many of the families that I would start to see asked me where they could get ABA therapy. My joke when I started 10 years ago was New Jersey or Maryland.
Yeah.
And I was half kidding and I half wasn't. It was nearly impossible. There was maybe five agencies in the state where families could really get access. And certainly it was even harder to find a company that was covered by insurance. So one family in particular asked if I would start an effort to try to change the landscape of services. Despite the fact that we had an insurance law, only 50% of companies in Pennsylvania are bound to follow Act 62. There are 50% of companies in Pennsylvania that are exempt from that. And that has to do with the size of your company or whether you're self-insured.
And my understanding was that all this is happening. And as a result of this, some people are getting this degree and maybe getting this degree here in Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. And actually, maybe you can speak to this, Dr. Ivey, because don't you train some of these?
Absolutely. I've been training graduate students in behavior analysis for close to 10 years now. And Pennsylvania has created a pipeline of sorts. However, that pipeline often leads outside of our state. So we invest capital, energy, resources to training students to be proficient behavior analysts. However, due to the lack of a license law in Pennsylvania, as well as other factors, many of our students, many of our natives go elsewhere looking for employment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that said, and that's very compelling, especially whenever you consider not only are people potentially not getting help they need, but also other people who are getting a good job, earning good money, they're going elsewhere rather than doing that here in our own backyard, being part of the economy and everything. I have to say, you know, I reached out to the governor's office for a few stories I've done on this, and you know, his office says they're not so quick to start to create another license. They don't necessarily think that, you know, creating a bunch of licenses for everything is necessarily a good solution. And you know, I can see the point to not further complicating things any more than they already may be. So I know you, Dr. Cherney, you spoke with the governor. Is that right?
Yes, actually, just this week, we had a meeting with the governor's office, not directly with the governor, but with his staff. And we tried to make a case for why licensure in this particular case would really be a very easy solution to a multifaceted problem. And it really is a bipartisan effort that we are taking. This particular bill that we're putting forward, which is House Bill 1900, the Better Access to Treatment Act, really is a very simple solution to a lot of problems that the state of Pennsylvania is facing. It would create jobs. It would keep so many of our behavior analysts that are being trained here to stay in our Commonwealth. It is a fairly inexpensive solution. We're investing in the education of our youth in master's degrees, in PhDs. We're not only seeing the outflux of these educated youth from Penn State, Harrisburg, but also from University of Pennsylvania, Drexel, Temple, Mercyhurst, Lehigh Valley. You know, our nonprofit is a collaborative, and we have faculty from all of those institutions that give us the same message.
Yeah.
So in addition, it helps vulnerable populations. So that would include the youth with disabilities, veterans with post-traumatic stress disorder, decreased aggression, help for seniors. Really, a lot of the governor's initiatives for this year.
Yeah, and that did interest me as I learned more about applied behavior analysis because, for example, people who might live with opioid use disorder is another group of people who can. Is that right, Dr. Ivy?
Absolutely. And if I could just add,
yeah,
one of the functions of this bill is to serve as a consumer protection because, as we spoke about earlier, at the current stage, there are many professionals practicing something that looks like behavior analysis, but often those individuals are not really qualified to interact with the complex material and/or develop interventions that really conform to the standards of the discipline. Now, to the point you just made, consider for a moment that many of the challenges that we face as a society, as individuals, these are challenges born of behavior. Somebody using illegal substances, somebody eating unhealthy food.
Yeah.
These are all products of behavior. And behavior analysts are in a unique position to understand how those problems are created and then ultimately how can we bring about some kind of change to those behaviors, some long-lasting change.
Right. It's so fascinating because it really speaks to how, you know, complicated human behavior is. And it's just, it's frankly something that fascinates me because I see it all the time when you post a story about anything, people all have their own opinions on, you know, well, you should have just not done that. And it's like, well, it's not always that simple, right? So let's talk a little bit about maybe what some of the Republicans you've interacted with have said, because I know you met with Governor Wolf. Have you gotten much of a feel from the legislature at all on this?
Yeah, actually, we have 106 confirmed co-sponsors. So that really speaks to the support that we have had. We have sat down with all of the legislators in the House, Pennsylvania House, and because we feel that when you say that we'd like to license behavior analysts, the first thing you get is, what is a behavior analyst? So nobody is going to vote yes for a bill that they don't understand.
Right.
So we've taken a grassroots, boots-on-the-ground approach where we have made one-on-one meetings with every single legislator, and we have found that this is a completely bipartisan effort. We have had just as much support on both sides of the aisle. It is a Republican-sponsored bill, and we've had a lot of Republican and Democratic support. It is not an issue of what side of the aisle you're on. Like I said, it has a lot of things that Republicans would value. It preserves individual liberties. It creates jobs. It reduces waste. And it also it protects veterans, seniors, I mean, all things that everybody can get behind. Mm-hmm. From the Democratic perspective, it protects vulnerable populations. And it also provides solutions to problems that we talk about but don't have really good solutions to, in particular, the opioid epidemic.
Right.
We talk a lot about, you know, we want to do something, but until now, we don't have great solutions for keeping people once they have treated their addiction in a rehab center, for example, once they go home, they really don't have a great way once they go back to their home environment not to succumb to the pressures of their home environment.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And we just have a little bit of time left. I'm gonna throw a question your way, Dr. Ivy, and ask, for people who might hear about this and think this might be the kind of work they would be interested in,
oh, sure.
What kind of person is a good behavior analyst?
A good fit for behavior analysis.
Yeah.
Oh, sure. Well, first of all, a behavior analyst is someone who takes a scientific, systematic approach to looking at the world. So many of the individuals who become the best students are those who are inquisitive, who ask the question, why do we do what we do? What are the variables that influence not only my behavior, but then the behavior of all of those around us? And then beyond that, behavior analysts have a real passion for bringing about socially meaningful change, to working in some of the most difficult, challenging situations, and really sometimes a crisis situation, to help families, team members, educators, and all related professionals come together and develop effective, long-lasting, impactful program, ultimately to bring about change that helps the individuals in need.
Yeah, thank you so much. Thank you both so much for being on here today. It was very enlightening to learn about applied behavior analysis, and I look forward to seeing what happens next.
Thank you so much for having us.
Brett, it was a pleasure. Thank you.
And that's it for today. Again, I'm Brett Schultes, WITF's Transforming Health Reporter, filling in for Scott Lamar. Tune in tomorrow, where Capital Bureau Chief Katie Meyer will be hosting. Bucknell University professors Debrina Dutcher and Karen Castle have spent the past 3 years leading a research effort testing two common vaping devices. Their research finds that electronic cigarettes release potentially harmful levels of carbon monoxide. The vaping industry has long said electronic cigarettes are less dangerous than smoking. Also on today's show, applied behavior analysis is a type of therapy that can help children with autism and people dealing with things like addiction and PTSD. But there aren't enough applied behavior analysts in Pennsylvania to do the work. Dr. Cheryl Tierney-Avis is leading an effort to change that and is getting a lot of support from parents who are desperate to get help for their children. She's joined by applied behavior analyst and professor Dr. Jonathan Ivey. Smart Talk comes up right after the news. Thank you.